Good day, ladies and gentlemen. I have a special guest today. It's not often I get a best-selling author on my channel, and I'm sitting here with Anthony DiStefano, who is not only the best-selling author of a book or two, he's an American author, television host, and activist who has written five best-selling Christian books for adults, including A Travel Guide to Heaven and 10 Prayers God Always Says Yes To. He has also written 16 best-selling books for children, including The Donkey That No One Could Ride and Little Star. Anthony, thanks for coming on my show.
Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Thank you. And today, my friends, I'm going to pull up his new book that we're talking about here. And I want to make sure that I have my link open for it, which I did before you came on. But of course, I've now misplaced it. Oh, there it is. And it's called The Story of the First Easter Bunny. So I'm going to share my screen here and we can actually all look at this together. You can see here, this is available from Sophia Press, called The Story of the First Easter Bunny. There's a preview, actually, which is really great from Sophia to do that. You can open it up and actually see what you're getting yourself into. So those watching at home, if you're listening on Spotify and iTunes, you can check this out on the YouTube. But if you're watching on YouTube, you can actually see really, really, you know, the colors really are Easter colors, but it still has that sort of tasteful kind of Catholic feel. I really like how the actual illustrator did this. And it follows the story of the Easter Bunny, or a bunny, at the time of the resurrection and the crucifixion and death of our Lord Jesus Christ. And so the first thing we should probably ask, we're told the Easter Bunny is just secular symbol. It's just like, it's like Santa is for Coca-Cola, the Easter Bunny is for Cadbury or something like that. Right, why did you pick the Easter Bunny, and is this really a Catholic theme?
Yeah, well, that's exactly why I did do this story. For years and years, I've been tired of this silly, secular Easter Bunny hopping in and taking center stage on what is the most holy Christian day of the year. You know, we have to be very, very careful about secular symbols. Now, generally speaking, the church doesn't rigidly oppose the inclusion of secular symbols like the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus in holiday celebrations. Some Catholic parents, even some very Orthodox Catholic parents, think that, you know, the inclusion of these kinds of characters can be fun to some extent. They could be used as a vehicle to add a little bit more excitement to the holy days for children, and therefore reinforce a deeper, joyful meaning of the holidays. You know, we want children to associate Easter and Christmas with the happy feelings of childhood so that they're memorable. And sometimes, if you're careful, then the addition of characters like this can make things fun for kids. But however, and this is a very, very big however, anyone serious about their Christian faith would say, I think, that you have to be extremely cautious when it comes to dealing with secular symbols of every kind, because parents cannot be blind to the fact that there is, as you speak on your program all the time, there's this ongoing culture war in our society. Our deepest beliefs are under constant and relentless attack from the media, from the entertainment industry. And the other side doesn't hesitate to try to jump over the heads of parents and propagandize children with their woke agenda. So children really are the front lines in the cultural religious war in which we find ourselves. And so we have to, in order to make sure that our core religious convictions aren't marginalized or compromised in any way, it's very true that we have to keep the true meaning of holy days like Easter front and center of any catechesis for children. I wrote my book because I thought there was a way to use the Easter Bunny for deeply religious purposes and to do it in a way that was helpful to parents, because, you know, I think that many parents find it difficult to teach kids about the true meaning of Easter because it necessarily involves death, the killing of someone, and death in any form can be scary. But to be able to give kids an idea of what the crucifixion and the resurrection are all about by employing an adorable, harmless little bunny in a way that's not so frightening, I think can be a very valuable tool to traditional Orthodox, Catholic, and Christian parents.
There's so much I could say to piggyback off of that, and I agree with everything. I wrote an article close to Christmas called I Believe in Santa Claus, and I went off of Chesterton's theme where he writes about how he believes in Santa Claus, and he actually learned to believe more and more in Santa Claus as he grew up. And I'm a huge Chesterton fan. I'm like Chesterton nerd 1000.
And me too.
Good. And You know, he says children, they believe in, how does he say it, about fairy stories and dragons.
We teach children fairy tales not to put into their minds the scary idea of dragons. They have those ideas in their minds already. We teach them and let them read fairy tales so they know that it's possible to slay the dragons through virtue, through being a virtuous boy or girl. You can slay all the dragons in your life. So we don't teach them that fairy tales to scare them.
Right. And yeah, and that's the point, is that the imagination is where your images are, and the eyes are the window to the soul. And you need to fill the minds of children with beautiful, wholesome images that they can relate to, because the culture will fill them with bad images if you're not careful. So I think your approach to doing this is exactly correct.
Yeah, thank you. And C.S. Lewis, by the way, said another good thing about the importance of baptizing the imagination. Baptizing the imagination, not in a sacramental way of baptizing children, but giving children those images that are going to be good for them, and that are going to grow and into a deep fervent faith.
That's excellent. So this book, how would you say, to use a term loosely here, how would you say that this book Christianizes or Catholicizes the Easter Bunny as such?
Well, one of the ways we can make sure that we keep the emphasis on Jesus Christ in holy days like Easter without sacrificing some of the fun and playfulness offered by characters like the Easter Bunny is to adopt them for our purposes, as I said, to Christianize them, to baptize them, so to speak. In my book, the main character is a bunny who lives in biblical times, in Palestine 2,000 years ago. And it so happens that he has a sick mother. He lives with a sick mother. She's very sick and she can't even leave her bed. And when the bunny hears about this amazing man named Jesus who can heal people with a touch of his hand, he gets it into his head that he might be able to ask Jesus to cure his mother. And being a good son, he immediately sets out on a journey to find Jesus. And in the process, he actually witnesses the main events of the Passion Week. He sees the Last Supper. He sees the crucifixion. And he even sees the resurrection. So what I've done is I've taken this secular fictional character and I've tried to make him into a witness to the gospel.
That's perfect. There's another children's book written about the crucifixion that focuses on three trees. Do you know which book I'm talking about?
The Wood of the Cross or something like that. It has to do with the one part goes to make into a boat, another into some. I'm aware of it, but I don't know the title.
This is a very powerful device, is what I'm getting at here, is that, you know, there's a reason why historically, you know, we sort of anthropomorphize animals and things like that for children's literature. For one, little animals are really cute and kids like cute things. That's just obvious. You know, we got a bunch of bunnies in our backyard running around in the country and stuff, and our kids are always looking at the bunnies. But also, it gives you a literary device that makes it like sort of a seamless approach where you can now insert a character that's fictional into the true story. Would you like to talk? Could you talk maybe about the importance of that in children's literature?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you pegged it. We use sometimes people will come up to me and say, "How come you just didn't tell the nativity story? How come you had to do it from the perspective of the Star of Bethlehem or from a grumpy old ox? How come you didn't tell the story of Palm Sunday? Just why did you have to do it through a donkey that no one could ride?" Which is a best-selling children's book I have, and there are two real reasons that we do that. The first that you said. Animals are cute and adorable. But why is that important? Because children find adults intimidating, which is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's a very good thing. Children find everything intimidating because they're so small. So when they're not intimidated, on the other hand, by animals, by cute little animals. And so when you have an animal in a story, the children are able to enter into the story immediately without any problem, without any difficulty. They're automatically in the story of the passion of Christ, you know, because of this little bunny that captivates them. The second thing is it does make it easier to teach about difficult things. As I indicated before, how do you teach children you want to teach children the true meaning of Easter, right? But yet parents are sometimes nervous or they don't know how to talk about the crucifixion, this brutal, bloody execution of a man. So oftentimes what they'll do is they won't talk about it at all. And what happens? The secular woke culture comes in and fills the vacuum with the Easter bunny and the dyed Easter eggs and Easter egg hunts and all those things that are so fun. And meanwhile, the child misses out on hearing the true meaning of the holiday. But if you use something like an Easter bunny and you employ him for Catholic purposes, it's sort of like in the game of pool. Sometimes you shoot the ball straight in the corner pocket. Sometimes it's better to use a bank shot. You hit the ball in the bank and it still goes in the hole, but you've done it in a different way. I view some of these books as using a bank shot. We're still teaching children the true meaning of Easter, but we're doing it in a way that's not as graphic. They're seeing it through the eyes of an adorable bunny. It takes the edge off a little, but we don't have to compromise our faith one iota. And that's the trick here, because all too often what liberal, progressive, even liberal Catholic authors will do is they will just water down the message so much that there won't be any message anymore. And they'll use the fact that children are afraid or frightened, you know, as rationalizations. So the idea is, how do you tell the full story without compromising the message? And this is, I think it's a clever way to do it by employing some of these little bunnies or oxes, et cetera.
I heard somewhere, so you and I were both talking about our Italian ancestry. My last name, as I always say, betrays me, there's a few things that actually that are just sort of ubiquitous in the culture. We don't realize they actually come from, especially even Italian Catholic practices. One of them is focaccia bread. The reason why it's the reason why we have it essentially is that during Lent they couldn't have any animal products, and so what they would do is they would eat bread with tons of oil, which gave them fat on top, and they'd use the herbs and the salt to give them the minerals they were missing. And I found out that was the origin of focaccia. But I've heard that the origin of the significance of eggs and rabbits was because eggs, obviously you couldn't eat eggs during Lent. So you'd gift someone an egg. And then if you're going to gift somebody something, you want to make it pretty. So it's pretty easy to see how that happens. And you see that with traditional Easter breads and things, they have the egg in them. But also with the rabbits, no one ate beef. No one was eating beef all the time, largely before refrigeration, because why would you kill your cow? You need your milk. So red meat was usually rabbits and other things like that. So basically it was like you'd usually have rabbit, maybe chicken or a rabbit cacciatore or something like that on Easter, and you'd eat eggs. Have you heard that tradition of why we have rabbits and egg symbolism?
I've heard that, but what I've heard more than that actually is that rabbits from pagan times were known as symbols of fertility because they multiply. Rabbits are famous for multiplying and spreading.
Right.
So fast. And so it sort of transitioned into early Christianity because we as Christians are called to be fruitful and multiply. Okay, so, and the same thing with eggs. Eggs have always been known as a symbol of fertility. And so if we're called to multiply, be fruitful, spread the word, fulfill Christ's great commission to make disciples of all nations, there's a possible connection there. But it's only a possible.
Yeah.
It's only a possible connection. When I was trying to come up, for years now, I've been trying to figure out how to Christianize the Easter Bunny. And the very first thing I thought of was maybe I could use this connection between fertility and the necessity of spreading the Gospels. But it just doesn't work for children. Imagine trying to explain to kids about sex, So finally what I did was I seized on this idea. I was at Mass one day and I was listening, and there was one of those many passages in the New Testament where Jesus says, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear," and of course, rabbits are famous for having large ears, and so the fact that rabbits have large ears, to me, it's much easier to use that as a connection than fertility. Throughout the whole Bible, we see this importance of having ears to hear. In Christian theology, that phrase means something very different than simply hearing words. It's about truly understanding those words and internalizing their message. Think about the parable, the sower and the sower and all the rest. So in this children's book, the bunny's enormous ears are not just physical attributes that rabbits have, but they equate to spiritual receptivity. And he becomes a model of the way Christians are supposed to listen to God. And I'm sorry for that long-winded answer your question.
No, that's really good. I had a rabbit as a kid, and he was white with black ears, so I called him Dipstick. I think I was in grade 5 or 6, and he had a tragic end. He got out of the cage, and there was a raccoon, and we won't go into that. That's the somber rabbit story. I was actually going to ask you about the large ear theme, but you talked about it. But there's another theme in the book. The mother is sick. What's the significance of the bunny's mother being sick?
Well, again, for entertainment purposes, in order to draw the child in, you know, you want to have some sort of connection between the bunny and Jesus. And of course, I've always had a very strong devotion to Our Lady. And when I wrote this book, I immediately thought of the fact that when Jesus was hanging there on the cross, the last direct action that he took was to entrust his mother to St. John. He said, "Son, behold your mother, and mother, behold thy son." Now, of course, we know that there's a lot of theological significance in that entrustment having to do with the church and Mary, who is the mother of the church. But beyond that deeper significance, it's also true on a strictly literal personal level that Jesus wanted to make sure that his mom would be okay after he died. And I thought that if the bunny in this story had a sick mother, and if he witnessed the crucifixion, and he heard with those big rabbit ears of his how Jesus had taken care of his own mother, then that might provide him with an even more poignant reason for visiting Jesus's tomb afterwards and praying that line I have in the book, which is, I think, "O man in the tomb, please won't you be kind? You helped your dear mother, now won't you help mine?" In other words, the fact that the bunny has a sick mother whom he loves and is trying to care for makes it even easier for him to relate to Jesus, who of course loved his own mother, Mary, better than any son could ever love his mother. So that's the main reason I wrote the story in this way, because I think it adds a strong emotional element to the book that most people can relate to. I want to say one other thing. I've always, sure. You know, you said in the beginning that I was an activist. I've always been a very strong pro-life advocate for decades. And anytime there's an opportunity for me to focus even in a limited way on the sacred bond between mother and child, I try to include that in a book.
Oh, that's excellent. Reminds me of Juan Diego, you know, the theme of his uncle being sick. And I have a special devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And I want to just show here again the illustration, because I want people to see just how, you know, I want to use this word loosely. It's cartoony enough in the sense that, yes, this is clearly a children's book, but it's not corny. You know, it's not like we're making the, sometimes you find with these little kids things about the Bible or something. It's just, there's something that almost cheapens the scenes that are actually biblical. Whereas this, I think it does a good job of actually kind of blending those two things. So the artist that you worked with, or do you want to say something? Sorry, before we go on.
No, go ahead. Keep going. I want to talk about the artist.
Exactly. So the artist that you work with, his name is Richard Cowdery. You've worked with him before. And why did you choose him?
You know, for all the children, I've written a lot of different children's books, and I pick, luckily I've been successful enough where I can pick my own illustrator. A lot of authors don't have that authority to do that, but I've been very blessed and my books have been very successful, so I can insist on who I want. And so depending on the theme of the book, I picked different illustrators. For instance, I did a book called Our Lady's Wardrobe, which was
We have that book.
Yeah, that's it.
I love that book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's an introduction to Our Lady to children by using the different clothes that she's worn in some of her approved apparitions. But in that book, I used someone who specialized at photorealistic paintings. And the reason I wanted photorealistic paintings is because I wanted to get across the theological idea that Mary is real. She's not some fictional character. She's not an Easter bunny. She's real. And in fact, she's been assumed body and soul into heaven right now. So I wanted the book to look very real. But in a book that uses animals, and we were just discussing the importance of animals before, I wanted to get someone who was the best in the world at doing animals. And what I mean is, Richard is I think the best at giving animals human-like expressions and features. And after all, these books are really about people. We mentioned this earlier. The animal characters stand for human beings. And the reason why, as I said, is that they're more approachable than adults. They're more adorable than adults. They're less intimidating than adults. Richard has this amazing ability to capture these adorable characteristics. And I think had he been living, you know, at a different time, 30 or 40 years ago, he definitely would have been recruited by Walt Disney to work on Pinocchio or Bambi or Dumbo or those early classic animated movies. And, you know, that's one of my main objectives in writing these kinds of books. I want to write Bible-based, Catholic, traditional books with powerful storylines and Disney-quality artwork. What we're doing is we're trying to tell the greatest story in the world. Why shouldn't we have the greatest production values? And what you just said a second ago is something that makes me annoyed and aggravated very much, that a lot of these, you know, the kinds of the stuff that we put out in the church and in fact, all, not just the Catholic Church, but all Christian books, children's books, a lot of times they have the worst production values. And I just don't understand it. Because we should have the best production values if we're trying to tell the greatest story ever told.
Yeah, I just saw the, I was at the premiere of the third episode of the Massive Ages trilogy in Chicago. And I've got a review that I won't release till the movie's out, obviously, in fairness to the, let people see it before they see my review. Anyway, the film was very beautiful. And one of the things I hammer home in the video review that I'll release, I guess, Tuesday night after the film is, we need to have strong Catholic art. There was a place called Christendom where strong Catholic art was the norm. You know, we were talking about Rome and Italy before we came on here. And, you know, you've obviously spent lots of time in Italy. I've spent lots of time in Italy. I mean, you walk around and it's just, even today where Italy has obviously in many ways sort of lost the faith and it's like so many countries, but the But the thing about that place is the bones, the scaffolding, the structure of that place is so Catholic. You can retrofit the faith right on it because even the way buildings are made, the little corner crucifixes you find in shops and things like that, the beautiful, tasteful art that you see throughout all the different mosaics and frescoes and things, that's what Catholics do. We must share with the people this ineffable joy, this almost inexplicable happiness and peace and centeredness and happiness that we need art to do it. You know, you need a song to do it. You need to have a painting to do it because you couldn't do it with mere words. So I think you're exactly onto something.
Yeah, well, you know, to go back to Chesterton and Thomas Aquinas, you know, you have the transcendent attributes of God, truth, goodness, and beauty. Truth, goodness, and beauty. Well, you evangelize people with the truth. You evangelize them with goodness, but you also evangelize people with beauty. Beauty is from God. Things are beautiful insofar as they reflect God in some way, and that's why there are different kinds of beauty because they reflect, they're like different reflections of God in the mirror. So yes, and at one time, the church understood this. And in fact, you were talking about focaccia bread before. But if you really want to think, look at it, the truth of the matter, all of Western civilization, all of Western art really comes from the church, yeah. All of it, not just the Renaissance and Leonardo and Michelangelo. But I wrote a book one time called Inside the Atheist Mind, and it was against atheism, and it debunked all the different claims of atheism. And one of the ways I did that was to show how much the church has given the world. And one of the things it's given us is all this tremendous art. So why shouldn't we try to recapture that glory that we've always had for 2,000 years?
I don't know if you saw it, but Tucker Carlson just did an interview with Chris Cuomo, which...
Yes. I caught some of that interview.
I'm not going to watch Chris Cuomo unless he's talking to Tucker Carlson. I'm just being honest about that. And I kind of don't watch a lot of news or anything, especially as of late. I've just sort of been checking out and kind of working on my other stuff. But I like Carlson. I think he asks great questions. And one thing in the interview, and he caught Cuomo off guard, and actually Cuomo was really palatable in this interview. I wrote an article for Crisis today on this very topic. And I said this was extremely refreshing because these are men who are clearly on the opposite sides of the political spectrum. But when they actually talked in person, they had so much more in common than you would think. And yes. Wouldn't it be nice if we are going to have this circus of politics, if at least those in the circus could talk to each other and be a little more reasonable, I think we'd be better off. But he talked to him about how much he loved being in Russia, which was so controversial. But he didn't mean the regime, but what he meant was he sort of had forgotten what it was like to be around beautiful architecture. And he brought up this idea of postmodern architecture being oppressive of the human soul. And it was such an profound thing. Cuomo actually said, you actually think that postmodern architecture like oppresses the human soul? He said, of course it does. It's the expression, what you make with your hands is the expression of what you believe inside. So if you believe people should be in a glass box, you know, with fluorescent lights in a square cubicle, then that's how you think human beings should be. Versus if you look at these classically Christian cultures and you think they should be in a place with archways and open air and windows and, you know, the different types of art, painting and things like that, then that expresses what you believe about the human person. That's something that we're really struggling with in our culture today.
Yes, and Chesterton, again, he wrote several great articles on cathedrals, on Gothic architecture, and the fact that it always looks like, if you look at a cathedral, it almost looks like it's on the move, it's on the march, it's reaching up to heaven. Look at the Notre Dame and those Gothic cathedrals. It's a reflection of Christendom, what you were speaking about. We were the church militant. We were on the march. We've got to take that culture back, you know? So I agree with everything you're saying.
I'm going to do a shameless...
I think Chris Cuomo has been trying recently to change his image a little bit. He's made a couple of comments even about Trump, I'm surprised that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he's trying. I think he may be trying to rebuild the Fredo image that he's had in the past.
Yeah, perhaps. And I'm going to do, speaking of beautiful architecture, Italy and so forth, I got to do a shameless plug for my pilgrimage. I'm just going to play a quick promo here. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm heading to Italy this fall with a traditional traditional Dominican Father Albert Calio, and we're doing a once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage opportunity. No trip to Italy is inexpensive, but this trip is very reasonable compared to what it would be if you did it on your own, significantly so. So link for that is in the description box for this podcast. Here's a quick promo, ladies and gentlemen.
Trouble in Rome. It is easy to forget about one unshakable fact. Our church is the Roman Catholic Church, and Rome is the Eternal City. What a perfect time to go on a pilgrimage to the Eternal City and the other monumental sites of Catholic heritage in beautiful Italy. Join Father Albert Calio and me this November as we tour through the shrines of Italy and the Amalfi Coast as we attend daily Mass in the Old Rite in the footsteps of St. Peter and St. Francis. Click the link in the description to register for this once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage to discover the heart of the Catholic faith in the heart of the old Roman Empire.
Go to kennedyhall.ca/Italy. There's a big red button that says click here. Click there and you'll find out all the information you need. All right, before we head out, I want to ask you one more question, and I want to put you on the spot with a book idea I have, because I need to have some professional advice, because you're obviously experienced. So one more question about the book and then my question. So in light of the miracle that occurs at the end of the book, what would you like readers to take away most from this story?
I think the main thing I like to communicate in this story is the true meaning of Easter, which is the central Christian message of hope and life after death. The fact that death isn't the end of the story. The end of the story is resurrection and life everlasting in heaven. God can pull good out of even the worst evil. That's a message that all of us need to hear over and over. And I think it's a message that kids need to hear very early, because no matter, you know, how much we try to shield and protect them from pain, there's just no way to prevent them from experiencing suffering and from grieving over people and even pets in their lives that die. When that happens, they have to be able to suffer and grieve in a healthy Christian way. And ultimately, I think that is the difference between believers and non-believers. It's not that believers don't suffer. I mean, that's not the only difference, but one of the differences is that it's not that believers don't suffer and grieve any less than non-believers, but they suffer and grieve with hope. They don't despair. And that belief in the resurrection and heaven is a gift we can give to our children that will help them have hope over the whole course of their lives. And it's a seed that I've tried to plant in this story and in all the children's books that I've written.
Excellent. Now, here's my last question. And you can be honest with me. So,
yes,
I have a children's book idea. So please, no one steal this, because if it comes out, I'll know you did. I won't be able to sue you, but I won't send you a Christmas card. So it's called My Father's Pipe. That's the title. And I smoke a pipe, and my kids actually kind of love the whole, you know, mythos of the whole thing, and just the whole ritual. They're like, oh, it's like a little fireplace on it. You know, they love it. And so the story would start outside of the church, and it's basically the vantage point is someone is telling a story, what it was like growing up with his dad smoking his pipe. And there were different moments where the pipe would come in. So it starts off and he's outside a church and it's dad talking to a friend and they're both have their pipes out. They're all very sharply dressed and it's got this nice Catholic scenery with outside the nice little church and stuff. And father's with them and talking. And, you know, the thing would be like, you know, my dad always used to smoke a pipe with his friends after Mass. And I said, why, Dad? And he said, the body's a temple of the Holy Ghost and it needs incense. You know, that's the first thing. And then it continues through the moments in life. And then at one point, for example, Dad is sitting in the kitchen table and he looks very somber. And the child sneaks down the stairs and said, you know, one night I found Dad after something really hard had happened to Mommy, you know. And I asked him, what are you doing here sitting? He said, you know, just like the smoke in my pipe, if I pray hard enough, my prayers are going to go up to heaven. You know, little things, little messages like that. And then in the end, it's going to end with the actual funeral of the grandfather. And the priest is doing the incense and stuff over the casket. And it sort of ends with that same theme. The body is a temple of the Holy Ghost and it needs incense kind of thing. Anyway, that's my story. Do you think I'm onto something there?
You know, I like the story very much, and certainly we need to explain to people out there what the purpose of incense is, going up to God. So that's all very good. I think what's going to honestly snag you there are the publishing companies, whether they're secular, mainstream, whether they're religious, Catholic, they're going to balk at the idea of the idea of smoking, because here it is, you're talking about the body's the temple of the Holy Spirit, and they're going to say, but isn't smoking bad for you? Doesn't give you cancer? And I don't think they're going to have enough courage to go ahead with that, even though it's very true what you say about pipe smoking being something that can be beautiful. I smoke once in a while. I smoke cigars once in a while. So I don't think it's that bad for your health. But I think that the publishing industry will put up a wall, not because the idea isn't good.
You're probably right. Okay, so we got to find. So, ladies and gentlemen, you got to pray for me to find a publisher with enough courage. Maybe Sophia. Maybe we can strong arm them. Don't worry, Sophia. I'm not gonna strong arm you on air. All right.
I'll try.
Thanks. All right. This has been wonderful, and we talked. You have other books. Come back on my channel anytime, and we can talk about some heavier topics that are not for children, but still obviously, useful to talk about. And before we go, besides going to the Sophia Press website, which I'll link for that in the description box. And by the way, people, if you are going to buy the book, just this, little scratch my back, I do have an actual affiliate code. And every time we sell one of these books, I get a little kickback. You know, we can help each other, help me help you kind of thing. So you can buy his book, beautiful book. It will arrive in time for Easter if you buy it, especially if you're in the continental United States. Sophia, they get there within 3 or 4 days when you order from the website. So you can maybe put in your Easter baskets and things like that for your kids. So do that. But where else besides Sophia can we check out?
The only place you can get it is through you. That's it. That's the only place, because we want to help you get money for that pilgrimage, which that beautiful pilgrimage. So
thank you.
Let people find the other ways to get it.
Yeah, the Amazon link is actually broken. You can only Sophia.
Exactly.
The whole internet is broken.
One place only, your podcast.
That's right. And what about where we can find your work in general for people that want to get in touch with you or something?
If people don't mind my long Italian name, I do have a website, www.anthonydestefano.com. I don't sell books there, but you could see everything that I've done.
Okay, I'll put that link in the description as well. Anthony, it's been a pleasure, and I'm really happy to have met you, and this has been an awesome conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, let me know what you think in the comments. This has been the Kennedy Report. Until next time, God bless you all.